He never played an instrument. He couldn't read music. He had no training in acoustics, no formal knowledge of arrangement, no technical understanding of what made one recording ring true and another fall flat. What Leslie Kong had was something that could not be taught and could not be replicated. An ear so specific, so tuned to the emotional frequency of Jamaican street life, that it let him hear the future in a voice standing barefoot on a sidewalk on Orange Street in 1961. That was the year a teenage boy named James Chambers stood outside the family business on Orange Street, Kingston, and began to sing. The Beverly storefront behind him was a combination restaurant, ice cream parlor, and record shop run by Leslie Kong and his two older brothers, Cecil and Lloyd. The business was modest, comfortable, and stable, the kind of enterprise a Chinese-Jamaican family built brick by brick through discipline and repetition. Leslie was the youngest of the brothers. He kept the books, managed the floor, and moved through the operation with the measured calm of a man who trusted systems and patterns. He was about to encounter something that belonged to neither. James Chambers had written a song specifically for this moment. He called it Dearest Beverly, a calculated appeal, the name of the shop woven into the lyric like a key cut for a specific lock. He was 16 years old, had no recording contract, and had chosen this storefront because he believed, with the particular certainty of someone who has nothing to lose, that Leslie Kong was the man who needed to hear him. Kong stepped outside. He listened. And when the song was over, he said yes. That decision, spontaneous, unscientific, and entirely dependent on the trust Kong placed in his own hearing, would alter the trajectory of Jamaican music more completely than almost any single act of business or art in the island's history. James Chambers would be renamed Jimmy Cliff. Beverly's Records would be born, and a Chinese-Jamaican ice cream shop owner with no musical background would become the most important producer of the first decade of Jamaican popular music's international expansion. What he built in the decade that followed, and what it cost him in the end, is a story the music industry in Jamaica still cannot fully explain. Leslie Kong was born on December 20, 1933, into the tight-knit Chinese-Jamaican community that had established itself in Kingston over several generations. His family was educated, stable, and community-oriented. Kong attended St. George's College in Kingston, one of the island's prestigious Catholic secondary schools, where he received a solid academic grounding that would prove more useful in the music business than anything a conservatory could have provided. By the time he and his brothers Cecil and Lloyd established Beverly's on Orange Street, Leslie was in his mid-twenties, operating a legitimate commercial enterprise in a city that was rapidly becoming a crucible of new sound. Kingston, in 1961, was a city where music moved faster than money. The sound system culture that Tom Wong, Duke Reed, and Cox and Dodd had built through the late 1940s and 50s had turned the city's yards and dance halls into laboratories for raw artistic ambition. Ska, that hybrid of American jazz and rhythm and blues, filtered through Jamaican rhythm and accelerated to a sprinting syncopation, was consuming the attention of every singer, selector, and entrepreneur with ears to listen. Kong understood the business dimension of this landscape, even if he had not yet participated in it. When Jimmy Cliff walked onto Orange Street with his manufactured appeal, Kong was already positioned to act. He had the shop, the infrastructure, and the commercial instinct. What he lacked was experience making records. He was about to acquire it at speed. Kong launched Beverly's Records almost immediately after the Cliff encounter. He recorded Dearest Beverly, the very song that had been sung at him from the sidewalk, and released it. He followed it with Hurricane Hattie by Cliff, a song built around a destructive 1961 storm that had battered Central America. That track, raw and propulsive, became Jimmy Cliff's first genuine hit. Kong discovered something critical in the process. He could hear what worked. Not in a theoretical sense, but in the visceral, immediate way that a market can be read by someone paying close attention to human response. Cliff, recognizing what Kong had done for him, took on an informal ANDR function at Beverly's. He began scouting talent in the places where talent lived. The yards, the sound system dances, the street corners. It was through this informal scouting that Bob Marley entered the Beverly's story. Accounts of exactly how Marley arrived at Beverly's have never fully agreed. Some versions credit Jimmy Cliff with introducing Marley to Kong directly. In other accounts, confirmed by Desmond Decker's own recollections, it was Decker himself who recognized Marley's talent first. Decker, who had begun recording for Kong after signing with Beverly's in 1961, knew Marley from their time working together at a welding shop in Kingston. Decker brought the young singer to Kong's attention. Those accounts go because he heard something in the voice that he believed Kong needed to hear. Whether it was Cliff's introduction or Decker's, or some intersection of both that the historical record never fully resolved, the result was the same. In 1962, Leslie Kong recorded Bob Marley's first singles. They were Judge Not and One Cup of Coffee. Marley was around 16 years old. The recordings were spare, tentative by later standards, but they carried something unmistakable in the texture of the voice even then, a quality that Kong heard and chose to record. The sessions produced nothing immediate in commercial terms. Judge Not was released and sold modestly. Neither song broke through in any lasting way at the time, and Marley's relationship with Beverly's did not continue. He would eventually find his footing at Studio One with Coxsonay Dodd, and later at his own Tuff Gong. But the first time that voice was ever captured on tape, the first time the world could have heard what was coming, it happened inside a Kong studio. On a day when two competing accounts later disagree about who opened the door, Kong never made a particular show of this. He moved on to the next record. What distinguished Kong from the other producers dominating Kingston's music scene in the early 1960s was not aggression, not charisma, and not the ability to play an instrument. It was the quality of his business thinking, where Duke Reed ruled through fear and Coxsonay Dodd through intellectual authority. Kong operated through precision, finding the right song, the right singer, the right moment, and recording it cleanly. He was, from early in his career, thinking about markets beyond Jamaica. In 1963, he made a decision that demonstrated both his commercial ambition and his tactical intelligence. He began licensing Scott recordings to Chris Blackwell's Island Records for release in the United Kingdom. Island was distributing Jamaican music to the growing Caribbean immigrant community in Britain through a subsidiary label called Black Swan, and Kong recognized that this was not a peripheral opportunity, but a foundational one. He became an original shareholder in Island Records alongside Blackwell and Australian engineer Graham Goodall, a fact that is rarely included in the popular histories of a label that would later be synonymous with Bob Marley's global rise. The partnership worked. Kong's productions were distributed through Island's network to British buyers hungry for the music from home. When Blackwell bought out Kong and Goodall's shares in Island in the mid-1960s, Kong did not retreat from the international market. He regrouped. In 1967, he and Goodall formed a new distribution partnership and established the Pyramid label in the United Kingdom, specifically to release the rocksteady and early reggae productions that Kong was then producing with extraordinary consistency in Kingston. Because by this point, Kong was at the height of his powers. The transition from ska to rocksteady in 1966 and 67 did not destabilize him. Where some producers of the ska era found the shift in tempo and feeling difficult to navigate, Kong adapted without hesitation. He kept his roster of core artists and worked within the new rhythmic language with the same forensic attention to sound that had defined his ska recordings. It was during this period that Desmond Decker became the instrument through which Leslie Kong would achieve something that no Jamaican producer had managed before. Now the studio work begins to accelerate. It is 1967, and the session for 007, Shantytown, is running in the heat of a Kingston afternoon. Decker stands at the microphone, the Beverly's All-Stars locked in behind him, Jackie Jackson on bass, Gladstone Anderson at the piano, Winston Wright on organ, Hux Brown on guitar, Paul Douglas steady on drums. The track is raw, specific, rooted entirely in the rude boy life of Kingston's West Side. Kong listens from the control side, says little, and lets the performance breathe. The track is pressed and shipped to Britain, where it reaches number 14 on the UK charts. It is a significant result for a Jamaican recording. But the real breakthrough is still 2 years ahead. Israelites Changed Everything. Recorded in 1968 and released in 1969, Israelites reaches number one on the UK singles chart in April of that year. The song then crosses to the United States, reaching number nine on the American charts in June 1969. The record sells over 2 million copies. In all of Jamaican music history to that point, no producer has achieved an international hit of this scale. The song was made in Kingston by a Chinese-Jamaican shop owner with no formal musical training, pressed by a small Jamaican label, and distributed to the world through a licensing arrangement built on personal relationships and commercial nerve. Leslie Kong was 35 years old. The achievement transformed what was possible in the minds of everyone working in Jamaican music at the time. If Kong could reach number one in Britain and break into the American top 10, then Jamaican music was not a local phenomenon waiting to be discovered. It was a global force that already existed, fully formed, waiting only for the right vehicle to reach the audience it deserved. During this same period, Kong had locked in the recordings that would define Toots Hibbert and the Maytals' legacy. 5446. That's my number. Toots' autobiographical account of his imprisonment for marijuana possession was recorded for Kong and became one of the defining songs of the reggae era. Monkey Man reached the UK charts. Sweet and Dandy. Audible in the studio scene of the 1972 film The Harder They Come, in which Kong himself made a cameo appearance as a recording engineer, was a Beverly's production. The period from 1969 to 1971 represented the apex of the Kong Maytals' creative partnership, with Toots writing and recording with a freedom and confidence that produced one essential document after another. The melodeons Rivers of Babylon passed through Kong's hands. The pioneers Long Shot Kick the Bucket, built around a famous horse racing upset at Caymanas Park in Kingston, went through Beverly's. Ken Booth, Bruce Ruffin, The Gaylands, Delroy Wilson, John Holt, and Stranger Cole, all recorded within the Beverly's system. Roland Alfonso of the Scatolites cut instrumental tracks for Kong during the Rocksteady years. The Beverly's All-Stars, Jackie Jackson, Gladstone Anderson, Winston Wright, Hucks Brown, Rad Brian, Paul Douglas, and Winston Grennan provided the rhythmic and harmonic foundation for the most productive period in the label's catalog. This was not one great artist's home. This was an entire musical generation's recording house. When Pyramid folded in 1969, Kong moved his UK licensing to Trojan Records and continued distributing internationally without interruption. By 1970, Beverly's was the most commercially successful independent label in Jamaica's history, and Leslie Kong was its invisible architect, the man who appeared on few photographs, gave few interviews, and let the music speak entirely on his behalf. He had no idea that the following year would be his last. The exact nature of what happened between Leslie Kong and the Wailers in 1970 has been told in different registers depending on who is telling it, but the broad outline has never been seriously disputed. Kong decided to compile and release a collection of tracks from his Wailers recordings, songs that Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Wailer had made in the early Beverly's years, material that had sat in the catalog since 62. The album, which would be titled The Best of the Wailers, was commercially logical. Kong had the rights, the recordings were real, and Marley's name was beginning to accumulate a different weight as Island Records prepared Catch a Fire. Bunny Wailer warned Kong not to release it. The warning, as it has been passed down through the accounts of those present in the Kingston music scene at the time, took the form of a threat of spiritual consequence, a declaration made in the language of Rastafari and the cultural context of a society where such declarations carried genuine social weight, that releasing the compilation without the Wailers' consent would bring Kong to his death. Those who were present have confirmed that the conversation happened and that the warning was delivered with complete seriousness. Think about what that moment contains. Kong, who had built his entire career on the trust he placed in his own hearing, standing in a room where Bunny Wailer is telling him not to go forward. The records are already cut. The rights are his. The commercial argument is clear. And there is a man telling him that a different kind of consequence operates in this space, one that contract law does not cover. Kong released the album in 1970. He died of a heart attack on August 9, 1971. He was 37 years old. The Jamaican music industry did not recover from the loss quickly. The community that had formed around Beverly's, the musicians, the session players, the singers, found itself without the quiet center that Kong had provided. The label did not survive his death in any meaningful commercial form. What it left behind was a catalog, over 2 million records sold on a single song, a roster that included the first recordings of Bob Marley, the international breakthrough of Desmond Dekker, and the most productive years of Toots Hibbert's life, all produced by a man who, when asked how he knew what songs to record, reportedly said only that he listened until something wouldn't let go. The precise cause of his death was cardiac. He had no confirmed history of severe heart disease in the public record. He was 37. He had, within the preceding 12 months, ignored a direct warning that releasing a specific album would kill him. Whether Bunny Wailer's curse was a spiritual reality, a psychological weight that placed genuine physiological strain on a man already carrying the pressure of running Jamaica's most commercially exposed independent label, or simply a tragic coincidence that the music community shaped into narrative because human beings require meaning, no one in the Jamaican music industry has settled the question. It is still mentioned. It is still unresolved. This is the thread the story could never fully tie off. Two accounts of who brought Bob Marley to Kong's studio in 1962, and one warning about what would happen if the recordings were released without consent, and then a man dead at 37 9 months later. The connection between these facts is not provable. It is also not dismissible. Leslie Kong is credited in the footnotes of reggae history. He is mentioned without being named as central. He is the Chinese-Jamaican shop owner who stepped onto Orange Street and said yes to a teenager's song, who signed the papers that made Bob Marley's first recordings possible, who licensed the tracks that built Island Records' early UK distribution network, who produced the first Jamaican record to top the British charts, who gave Toots Hibbert the studio environment to make the music that would define him, and who died at 37, having said yes to one thing too many. The question the Jamaican music community has never fully answered is not whether Bunny Wailer's curse worked. It is whether, if Leslie Kong had lived to 60 or 70, we would understand that the entire international history of reggae was shaped in the first instance by the commercial intelligence and human receptivity of one man on one street corner in 1961 who stepped outside to listen. Was the curse the cause? Or was the weight of what he had built, the accumulated pressure of a decade at the center of an industry with no safeguards and no precedent, the real thing that stopped his heart? That is the question. Orange Street still does not answer, and that is why the name above the door of the shop that helped build Jamaican music's global future was Leslie Kong's, even if the history that followed his death never quite put it there.